Okay, so I'm going to start by a semi-apology because this is the first time I'm talking about this particular piece of work, and I actually wasn't prepared at all. But I'm really grateful for the opportunity to talk to all of you because, you know, we sort of were doing our work, and I realized we're coming a little bit from outside this community. I'm very excited to get to know you all. And so this is, so I will probably screw up at some point during this because this is really prepared at the last minute, and I speak a slightly different language. But I want to give you an idea of how we're thinking about some of these things, and because I think some of it will be useful in sort of comparing notes. And there's definitely a lot of overlap. But first of all, I also want to say, I'm thrilled that people are thinking about eccentricity. We started thinking about eccentricity a couple of years ago, and I think the only paper we could really find, I mean, there were obviously lots of papers, but the one that motivated, that we were looking at a lot was Antonini and Peretz. And basically, when we started working on it, most people said, you know, they'll never measure it, why are you doing this? Whereas, you know, just to put it in perspective, I'm coming from, you know, particle physics viewpoint, we're always looking for new things. And so we wanted to see, you know, what are the things that you can measure that we might not know you can measure yet? Oh, sure.
I might mind, because I'd be embarrassed to myself during this talk.
So essentially, you know, we really want to see, you know, how we can measure things. And in particular, we had some very highfalutin kind of goals in the beginning, you know, could you measure dark matter? And then we realized, you know, how little we know about these black holes. And in particular, where do they come from? And I guess at the time we started doing the work, the name of the game was sort of measuring spin to try to distinguish different formation channels. And as we know, that's, first of all, it's challenging. There's a lot of degeneracy. But second of all, I mean, let's get all the information we can. So, you know, we just started, you know, we were coming fresh to this, and I should say this is all work done, and he's really responsible for a lot of it, Zhangji Hanyu, who's a postdoc at Harvard. He's really great, and he's responsible for a lot of this too. So we were just thinking about what we can measure, and so we just, you know, really just went step by step to see, like, what are the things you can have, and, you know, and one of the things we thought was if you want to learn the environment, one of the things you want to know is what, you know, what are the tidal influences, so what is nearby that's affecting the orbit. And of course, as was just pointed out, a lot of, you know, as we learned, a lot of the eccentricity, even if it's there in the beginning, will be lost by the time you get to the LIGO band. And so a lot of the work was sort of trying to see what contend with what you can measure, even if that's true. Okay? So we did a number of papers. So this is by way of sort of, I mean, I did not prepare a very long talk, and I certainly didn't prepare a talk on all these subjects. But I just want to let you know what we did in case any of it is interesting or relevant, and I'll give you just a flavor of a couple of the things. So working from the bottom, the first two papers we did were actually trying to get an analytical understanding of what the numerical results that were Antonini and Peretz in Antonini and Peretz. In particular, we were considering binary systems orbiting a large central black hole. Now that may or may not turn out to be a very important channel. But from the point of view of doing something analytically, it's beautiful because it's something that's stable. You can actually see what's going on, and you can. And it turned out amazingly, you can actually have a very good analytical approximation to what's going on. And I'll point one slide. But and having an analytical approximation is useful for many reasons. But one is if you did see it. I mean, in a very optimistic scenario, if you measured a lot of them and want to understand what distribution it reflects, of course, having an analytical formula helps a lot rather than having to simulate. Do an n-body simulation for every one of them. I mean, basically, if we have the profile of the black holes and also the stars, because you do need to know about evaporation, if you have that, then you can calculate more or less what eccentricity distribution you expect at the end of the day as a function of where these orbits are located with respect to the central black hole. So that's very useful. It's also useful for things that that was just pointed out, for example, the correlation between eccentricity and mass. We could actually do that analytically and actually got a different answer than was found in that paper, but that's because it's a different channel. So it could be used as a way to distinguish channels. So there's really very nice things you could do once you have these analytical formulas. But we are faced with the fact that, in fact, and basically with Kozai-Lidov, you can really build up eccentricities to large values, but most of the time, as was pointed out, you are going to lose it. So it's just the tail end of the stuff that you can maybe hope to see in LIGO. And, you know, look, you know, we have what we have. It's worth seeing if we can find it. It's definitely, and also, even if we say we don't care, the fact is, if you really do have any kind of significant eccentricity, even if it's even like 0.1, it will confuse your determination of parameters. I mean, you will extract them incorrectly. if you don't put this in. So it is really, if the fact that this degeneracy works both ways, it means it's hard to measure, but it also means it can interfere with what you think you are measuring when you have a limited parameter space. Paper number three that we have there, I'll just mention briefly, is also kind of interesting because, you know, so we had done all this work on LIGO and then realized, of course, in LISA, as was pointed out, you do have high eccentricities. Not only do you have high eccentricities, if you have things like Kozai-Lidov, you can actually see the effect in real time in some sense. I mean, because you really have binaries that are orbiting a central black hole. You can actually hope to measure a Doppler shift. If they're very far away, you would sort of measure it through an acceleration. But if they're close enough, you might even see a Doppler shift as a function of time. And so that's what that paper is. It's just, if you actually look in, and again, this is something that could confuse extraction parameters, but it's also really interesting because you really have hope to see directly this motion. And if it's close enough, you can actually distinguish the different orbital parameters. I mean, there is, of course, a possible confusion between incorrect chirp mass and having this outer orbit. But if you're close enough, you really can distinguish the different parameters and really see this thing orbiting in real time, which would be, of course, extremely interesting.
So I think this is something that you can also do with, in principle, with white dwarf binaries in the Milky Way, right? If they are in triple, in hierarchical triples, I think Mikornish and Mikorta-Manini.
That's right. He was looking more, I think, at neutron stars, where you have a lot of them, like, so you have compact objects. So what was different in our paper, just for the record, is there's an issue of decoupling the actual orbit, the change in orbit, from just getting the masses incorrectly and just having a chirp. So he considered systems that aren't chirping,
sure.
That you have no confusion. What we did is we did a more, and if it's far enough away, you can't distinguish the two. What we showed is where you can distinguish the different parameters. But yes, that's correct. Yeah. So it turned out when we were doing this, they were doing something very similar.
Yeah, it's just another way to see this.
I mean, look, there's room for all these different things, though, right? And I think it's really great. The second paper, I'll just show a quick plot from that, too. So that was what I said about, and I just want to correct what I had said. I said that you can actually see the peak frequency changing, in principle, in the LISA band. That is, if there is Kozai-Lidov oscillation. Otherwise, as was said, you kind of have this fixed peak frequency. But if you have Kozai-Lidov oscillations and eccentricity is close to 1, and you get it close to 1, you actually can see events that look very different where they enter and leave the LISA band, which would be extremely interesting because I think there's a debate whether we've seen it in pulsar systems, but I think it might be the first time we really see Kozai-Lidov in action. I mean, there's nothing else that would explain that. And what most of the talk today is about the first paper, which relates to a lot of the issues that were discussed about connecting the LISA and LIGO bands, and a little bit lightheartedly, but I think it's really kind of true. I would try to argue that you sort of can measure eccentricity without measuring eccentricity. And it's really based on some of the things that were pointed out, that a lot of the things that you see in LIGO will miss the LISA band if they're eccentric. And the really interesting thing that I hope to convince you, at least briefly, is that it turns out, this is just complete coincidence, that the LISA band seems to have just the right frequency range to distinguish dynamical channels from non-dynamical channels, even if you can't do a measurement of eccentricity. So even if you have no eccentric templates, if you're measuring, up to 0.01, if you see a reduction, and again, this is, there's going to be a lot of numerical work to follow this, but if you see a significant reduction in what you would expect based on the LIGO rate, it could be an indication of eccentricity. And of course, you can check that with eccentric templates and also, as was pointed out, but if there are in the future gravity wave detectors in this intermediate frequency range. Because essentially, what's going on is the peak frequency is being pushed out of the LISA band, and some of the bands just don't even reach LISA, or if they do, they reach eccentricity. And so, that if you don't have an eccentric template, you just wouldn't see it. So, it's pretty cool. Okay, so this was just what I was. This is just a mention, and this is not the title of the talk, but I just want to mention this because I would like to hear what people have to say about this, but it's really interesting. Again, this is if the eccentricity is near 1. Like I said, if it's not near 1, you could hope to see this orbital stuff that I've talked about to represent Kozai-Lidov. But that orbital, that shift could be attributed to various different things, but in this case, there's nothing else that would do this. You would see, if you can measure this, if you had a template for this, and this, you would be able to see events that enter and leave the LISA window. because the eccentricity changes so much, and the peak frequency scales is 1 over 1 minus e to the 3 halves. So the eccentricity changes quickly because it's near 1, and you have Kozai Lidov in real time in the 5-year or 10-year time period. You can actually see events that enter and leave LISA. Of course, this is not going to be most events. It's very rare. But it would be, even seeing one of these would be incredibly interesting.
I mean, I think this would be a challenging thing.
Absolutely challenging to see.
Because, you know, to see it, it's probably not going to be ISNR. We need some template, some way to explain.
I mean, we assumed a template and had significant ISNR, but of course, you know, the question is whether you really, I mean, obviously, if you don't look for it, you probably won't see this.
Sure.
I mean, there might be some sort of burst and you might throw it away. I mean, it's sort of what this is saying, and I think this has kind of come up a lot in conservation. Some of these bursts are actually really interesting, and we'll have to be more careful when we get to LISA.
What is the rough estimate of how often this might happen?
I think if we're lucky, I mean, it depends on how many of these are. This is based, again, on something like near the galactic center, so it depends on what fraction there is. So, you know, you might see a handful of these. You're not going to see a lot of them. It would be a handful. And like I said, the only reason, because, you know, so ordinarily you say, who cares, but I don't think we've actually seen real-time Kozai Lidov ever. It's not impossible that we will see it before LISA turns on, but if we don't, it would be really interesting.
So I think you had alluded to, was it possibly 40 weeks and 20 minus 30, where there's the prospect that people suggested?
Right.
But it's obviously not very direct.
Well, they sort of, yeah, I mean, exactly. This is like a real thing where you really see the here you really are seeing the eccentricity of something, and you're not associating with something else. Yeah. I mean, the peak frequency is directly a function of the eccentricity here, and you're directly seeing that change.
So I guess this is something that you can always, you know, search a posteriori in the data, right? So if you see a bunch of eccentric binaries in LISA, then you might have a hint that, you know, some of that, you know, there might be something like this as well in the data, because these dynamical channels are important, right? So
think about this. So this is a binary with a supermassive black hole. And
30 solar mass? Yeah, these are all.
And then there is a third body.
Yeah, so there's all of these, unless I say otherwise, almost always I'm thinking, I mean, when we did our analytical calculations, we were thinking of stellar masses black holes around central major black hole. And the question is, you know, and they have to be close enough for this to happen.
But in our galaxy or outside our galaxy? For this to be seen by LISA.
It could be anywhere. We used, as a nominal mass, the mass of our central black hole.
No, I'm just getting an idea of...
it could be anywhere.
I mean, the signal, you mean the
binary.
I mean, 30 solar masses can be GW15,
I-14. Yeah, this doesn't have to be in our galaxy.
I just want
to
understand the
idea. You have a supermassive black hole there.
Yeah, but what you're seeing is the signal from the stellar mass binary.
Yeah, 30 solar mass black hole is just the perturber.
Oh, the perturber.
Sorry, the 10^6 solar mass black hole.
I mean, the perturber is the supermassive black hole.
The perturber is the supermassive black hole. Correct.
But just so the eccentricity is like 0.95 or something.
It has to be really high for this.
So what you're really seeing is you would be looking for a few non-periodic bursts.
Yep.
With LISA.
That's correct.
And I think identifying them as connected to each other is going to be challenging.
Well, no, in this case, it's even worse than that. You're seeing like one burst, right? Because, you know, I mean, it depends on the period, but you're not necessarily seeing this happen again and again. This is something where, if you're lucky, I mean, this is sort of, you know, this is an example.
But one burst is just a single paracenter passage. I mean, how do you distinguish? If you just see one burst, how do you know that there's real-time Kozai? It's just an eccentric orbit.
It has a shape. I mean, it's a very distinctive shape of the peak frequency as a function of time that you would see. So,
but it's different than just a single paracenter passage?
Yeah. I mean, well, because...
Being perturbed at the paracenter.
But it's what you're thinking of, that you have the orbit, which is Kozai Lidov perturbed, and you have many orbital cycles.
That's correct.
The eccentricity is changing gradually.
Yeah, that's
so
correct.
You see a gradual change in the paracenter passes, but that would only happen once in your observation.
Correct.
So you see lots of cycles, but only for one sequence.
Yes.
I guess that's right.
So it is non-periodic burst. You're seeing many paracenter passes.
Yeah, it's not a single burst. The single paracenter is a... It's an eccentric binary with a peak frequency that is moving in and out.
Right, but the binary is so eccentric that the way you would see it, at least, is as a burst at paracenter, and then there'll be another one. The bursts will change as the coli lead off.
That's correct. That's correct.
Yeah, it'll be a sequence of evolving bursts.
I guess that's what the right pattern
is. So
that's over.
Well, but the right time this, that's what this is. Exactly. But this one is showing as a function of time.
But that spectrogram on the right is a slice of that in 20 years.
Yes, it's like 20 years.
That's right, but it's a slice over, you know, 5-year interval.
Yeah. Over a lease of time.
That's what we have. You know, it's what we have. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, this is definitely not the last word on any of this, but this is to say I think this would be really interesting to look into more. So. We did think about the signal to noise, and it is true that if you don't have templates, it would be hard, the signal to noise would get. So you probably will want templates where you do want to look for those correlated bursts, as we pointed out. That's up. Right. Okay. I'm not going to go into this at all, but this is just to say, again, that for some of these events where you really have things that are near, this is saying that you can actually have an observable Doppler shift. And if you have an observable Doppler shift, it'll be very interesting, because then you can actually distinguish what kind of parameters you have for your binary that are producing your cosi lead out effect. I mean, I think that's going to be a really cool thing to measure. I copied these words just because I just want to point out that the correlation of eccentricity and mass really depends on the formation channel. And we had an analytical formula, so we could actually see, in some cases it's correlated, in some cases it's anti-correlated. So so that's, again, worth looking at. Okay. So that's all I'm going to say about previous work. I'm very happy I'm here this week. You guys are here this week. I'm very happy to follow up on any of it. And I do hope you have more papers and tell me interesting things about them. Okay. But this is something that Shangji and I just completed, and we hope we completed. There might be more work to be done. But this is just an interesting thing. So it was sort of based on, you know, we sort of started off, you know, during the time of the white paper, people were thinking about correlations between LISA and LIGO. So I wasn't actually aware of some of the literature, so I apologize for that when we did this. But basically, the point is that the number that you would see in LISA, it's not just a straight, if it's circular, then it's very straightforward to do it, and that was done by Sasana, to figure out what you would see. The LISA-LIGO correlation is really, it's very nice work. But if you have eccentricity, the number that you will see in LISA, as I was pointing out, is affected by where your peak gravitational frequency is. So it can move you out of LISA window if you have eccentricity. This is another thing you have to take into account. It's very important to do this with fixing the peak frequency, which is where what you really see. You need an enhanced number density to produce the LIGO observed rate. So if you have if everything was eccentric with some given eccentricity, you would have to have more events because they wouldn't merge in time. So you'd have to look at what you get in LIGO window. And that's a tricky thing because we usually think of the eccentric ones as merging faster. But the point is to get the peak frequency in the right place, then you have to adjust. Then you're saying basically you have larger orbits, and when you have these larger orbits, then you find that the lifetime is actually longer. So it's a combination so that's why it's important to fix the peak frequency. So you have eccentricity, but then you have to figure out for the LISA window what is your A parameter, what is your separation, and then for that you find that you actually need to have more events. So that looks like it would enhance the number. Then we also calculated a reduced signal to noise, and Shangji actually did a very nice analytic calculation of what the signal to noise would be for these events. Okay, for events in LISA. Okay, for the eccentric events. Okay, so what I'm going to try to convince you in this briefly, in this paper, if you observe the number of binaries as a function of frequency, you can actually determine whether it's determine whether there are dynamical channels contributing or isolated channels contributing. This is based on the predictions people had for what the eccentricity distribution in LIGO is expected to be. Okay. So what we did is we took the eccentricity distributions from LIGO that were predicted for LIGO, we followed them back to get to the earlier time, and then we find out what frequency band they would be in and see what you expect to see. And this will become clearer as I give the talk, I hope. But the key thing is that even if you didn't have any eccentric templates, you would be able to see something that would signify that there are eccentric events, namely a reduction of events. Now, rejection of events could be because you had the math function wrong, but it actually is different as a function of frequency. And so this should be able to be used to distinguish which is the case if we can measure things at different frequencies. Okay. And if you can detect modest eccentricities like 0.1 or 0.4, you can really further check this interpretation. So this is related to what we said earlier. This is just a bunch of channels. I mean, we might end up with more. You said there were 30. I only have like 5 or 6 here. But this is the predicted eccentricity ranges. Now, of course, this leaves out the non-perturbative events that were discussed where you could get large eccentricity. I mean, those you don't have any hope of seeing in LISA, so we're not talking about them. Okay. So we're talking about the ones that are more or less perturbative. You see that sort of the biggest eccentricities are so near the galactic center or in cluster. Then for isolated and ejected events, you basically have much smaller eccentricity. Now, none of these eccentricities are measurable in LIGO. This is just the expected distribution. You might have some tail that is measured and measurable. That's what I mentioned earlier. But those you also won't see in LISA, as we're going to see. So basically, you notice that there's sort of this distinguishing region here between roughly 10 to minus 5 and 10 to minus 6 for the predicted eccentricity that would distinguish dynamical and non-dynamical channels. Okay? And we're going to see what this translates back into.
Mm-hmm. I thought for after his talk, I mean, he had a plot showing the distribution of eccentricity. It could go to large eccentricity for.
This is not very large. This is 0.01, right? This
yeah, just, so it can go.
That's what I was saying. I said you can potentially get larger values, like where larger is 0.01 or 0.1. That's
like
a tail.
I think some of the channels that Carl included in his distribution before are not included in this in-cluster distribution.
Yeah, it's the very optimistic direct capture.
Like the capture.
Yeah, so the direct capture ones, like I said, those are the non-perturbative ones that I'm not including here.
But in any case, your point is 10 to minus 5 is going to separate.
Yeah, roughly. Yeah. Roughly the ones that would be 10 to minus 5 in LIGO. And we're going to trace back now and see what that corresponds to at earlier times. Okay. And that was actually done, as was pointed out, by one of the pictures. Okay. And this is just to remind you what peak frequency is. It's just that it has this dependence on A times 1 minus E, essentially. So when E gets big, that gets significant. And basically, you can use this to trace back. So we know how the orbital radius changes. We know how the eccentricity changes. But that's not enough because we really don't want A. We want the peak frequency because it's not directly, you know, if you have circular ones, we know that the frequency is just related to twice the orbital frequency, but that's not true when they're eccentric. So it's better to just work directly, forget A, and just work directly in terms of peak frequency. So most of you probably know this G function that tells you how eccentricity changes as A changes. What we have here is a function that shows how eccentricity changes as frequency changes, or vice versa. Okay? So by plugging in, just inverting and using the formula for peak frequency. Okay? And that's the relevant formula here. Okay. So you can use that, and then you can just trace back where things end up. And you see some interesting stuff. So you see, first of all, if you look at the LISA window, you see that it's a lot of events sort of overlap the LISA window, but you see that that a lot of them enter at fairly high eccentricity when they're in the LISA window. Okay. So you also see that there are ranges of eccentricity, like 10 to minus 2, that doesn't even make it to the LISA window. 10 to minus 3 doesn't even make it to the LISA window, if you trace it back. So if you had large eccentricities, and just trace this back of what this formation channel is, you find that you just don't even get into LISA window. I mean, if we do build these other detectors, it's going to be really interesting, because we will see them there, and that was also pointed out. And this is one thing that we, you know, you don't have to work to make this happen. It's really entering in these bands, okay? So this is what you see, okay? Now, if you have isolated channels and really small eccentricity, they're fine. They just go straight through, and then you would see them, okay?
To understand this, if I remember correctly, the peak frequency is roughly the circular frequency at pericenter for a highly eccentric orbit.
Correct.
So it's essentially what you're saying is that 10 to the minus 2, that peak frequency is already too high, and because Cheryl was saying the pericenters can serve for very high eccentricities, it's just always at 200 frequencies.
That's right. And the other thing that I didn't point out when I said this formula is that this H function has this property that it actually has a limit. So when you actually trace things back, there's actually, I mean, and this is sort of clear in the plot, there's actually some minimum frequency that these things can get to, right? You can trace this all the way up to eccentricity 1, and they don't get lower than that frequency. So there will actually be a frequency cutoff on where you can end up as a function of how eccentric your events were.
Although, just again, to try to be as clear for myself about this as possible, the peak frequency never drops below something.
Yes.
Right.
But there are frequency components that go as low as you like if you're able to trace it back to a parsec separation or something. Right?
Yeah, so there are, right, it just, so we really were looking at peak frequency, that's true. So you might have, I mean, but already, you know, you have to worry about signal to noise. So, and so this is definitely interesting follow-up work to see whether you can, what you can get. If you know how far down you can go in signal to noise, that's a good point.
So I'm missing that. So what's happening is it's very eccentric and it's sort of, I mean, look.
It
what,
starts
what's
off
happening when it hits one is that you're just getting something that goes way out, comes in, sweeps around, and goes back.
I'm sorry. Say it again.
I'm just trying to understand what happens at one. Like what is the actual binary looking like?
It's basically saying that it was formed, you know, more or less forming there.
So I mean, the claim is it's just that you had a capture of that very radial capture.
Whatever happened to form it, we're leaving that in open. So in this plot, it's an open question. Eventually, we'll overlap it with formation channels. We're just saying that whatever it is that allowed you to get a large eccentricity, a relatively large eccentricity in LIGO, not a measurable one, but a relatively large one in that frequency band, had to be formed. More or less at this frequency. If it was formed earlier, it just wouldn't get to LIGO.
But it's not that if I took a LIGO banner and ran it backwards, it would unbind at some point.
Oh, no. No, that's not what I'm saying. Yeah. I'm just saying it's not radiant peak frequency. And it's a good question. We didn't think about all the other components and how much signal to noise you could conceive of the gap.
But this plot is not summarizing in another way what Carl was showing in this plot from other papers where we were seeing, you know,
it's related
black,
to what
beautiful blue, yellow, whatever tracks.
Yeah, so it is related to that.
It's more
right.
or less the same information, but put in another. In a different plot.
That's right. I'm going to show how we can use it, though, to parse into other information. That's right. So what you'd want to do, right, so in that plot, they separated out, essentially, that was, I think it was mostly for globular clusters that people were doing. This is leaving open. So there it was saying a specific formation channel. Here I'm just leaving open the question of how they were formed. I'm saying whatever formation channel would lead to a certain eccentricity in LIGO. So this would include everything. It would include the ones, you know, near the galactic center, near a black hole in the center, for example. So it's not saying it was formed necessarily. So I think there was more like moving forward. It was saying, look, this is what's happening in globular clusters. Where does it end up? And here we're just leaving open that question. So it's overlapping information. It's more or less the same, analytical procedure. Yeah. So it's going to end up being a slightly different interpretation of how it can put together this result. But it's related for sure. Okay. Other questions about that plot? So now let's just put it together. So let's put together the formation channel, and Lisa band, basically using what we just said. So this is sort of the main result in some sense. Okay. So suppose that we don't have eccentric templates, but our templates basically cover eccentricities up to 0.01, right? So if you have up to 0.01, you're going to still detect it with a circular template, okay? So that's what this line is here, okay? And then you can ask what you can actually hope to see. You know, what E0, and this is E0 at 10 hertz, which are the ones that you can hope to see? And you see that there's this sort of cutoff here, right, at 10 to the minus 5. So somewhere between 10 to the minus 5 and 10 to the minus 6, the peak frequency will be in the LISA band, okay? But if the peak frequency, but if you start off with higher eccentricity, you're outside the LISA band. Your peak frequency is outside the LISA band. You're not, you know, again, I should be careful about saying you're not detecting it, but you're certainly not detecting the large signal to noise that you would if it was in there, okay? And you see that this is just a complete accident, as far as I know. But you see, it's really potentially extremely useful in distinguishing the dynamical and non-dynamical channels. It just happens to fall exactly in that region where, I mean, if these predictions are correct, where you would be able to distinguish them. So that's kind of the key result. Now, suppose you can make templates. Suppose you made a template like 0.4, which people have certainly talked about. Then you see that you can actually get a good fraction of the events, not all of them, but then you'd be able to see it. So what you'd be seeing in this case is you'd be noticing that without the eccentric templates, you're missing a huge, huge fraction if dynamical channels contribute a lot. Then you put in this eccentric template, and it doesn't have to be a crazy eccentric. I mean, it could just be like 0.4. Even if you had 0.1, you would still get a very significant fraction of the events that have been lost, okay? So I'm going to just show that in a couple of different ways, but that's really the key result. So to get the numbers, as I said, we need all these things. We need the rate, we need the signal noise, and both as a function of frequency. So this is in the paper. I don't want to give a very long talk here, but there's the signal to noise. You see that eccentric events do have lower signal to noise in general, at least the way we think they're calculating signal to noise. You do, however, get some enhancement if your eccentricity is not too big because of this effect that the rate has to be bigger to give, if it's accounting for the LIGO rate. So eventually we're going to have to add up populations, see how all this works together. But this is just if you had just that eccentricity for all the events, this is the rate you would get. You see about 0.4, you end up with some enhancement. Because the signal to noise isn't killing you too much, but you are getting a reasonably significant enhancement. Okay? So we put that together. And again, I just want to mention Zhang Ji, you played a big role in this, all of this work. So we just say, so we required signal to noise bigger than 8 for this, and we just asked what you would see. And this is, it's pretty cool, okay? So we go to frequency, and we ask, suppose you just had circular. Well, you don't see that much, right? Because if you had, so here, okay, so this is in order of increasing E naught. Okay, eccentricity. So that E is E naught. E naught, what the eccentricity would be at 10 hertz. Okay? So if it's really small, even if you have E less than 0.01, that's your template, you'd be able to see a significant amount. You would still have a cutoff in frequency. You still wouldn't get to low frequencies, but you'd see a significant amount. Of course, if you now have another template, 0.01 to 0.1, you'd see a bit more. This small red thing are the events that you could hope to see in both LIGO and LIGO. So it's really few events where it's the same event. This is just distributions. These, you know, we have this lovely picture that we can take LIGO and predict what we see in LIGO, but that would be just very, very few events. Okay, very, very few events. So now we can say, suppose you go to bigger eccentricities. If you go to bigger eccentricities, you see that if you just had circular, you basically are not seeing anything, okay, for these guys.
Sorry, I actually, maybe it's just me, but I don't see the plot for yourself.
Okay.
Is it just me or is the plot? You said it completely.
Okay, so this is number of events. So the number of events was calculated based on what we've seen in LIGO, and assuming sort of all events have that eccentricity. So eventually we'd want to really add it up with different distributions. And this is a function, and the x-axis is frequency, so you're seeing events as a function of frequency.
The peak frequency.
Yeah, the peak frequency.
And what is written on top of?
Right, so that's what I was about to say. Yeah, so what's written on top is assuming what this E star or E naught parameter was, what would be the eccentricity in LIGO, okay? So it's not a measured eccentricity, but that corresponds, that is a way of distinguishing the different distributions. So if it's really big, it's some sort of dynamical channel. If it's really small, it's like an isolated event. Okay. So events that are like of that sort are getting more and more isolated. Events of this sort are getting more and more isolated. Events of that sort are getting to be, are definitely dynamical channels because they had significant eccentricity in the LIGO bound. Okay. All right. So
more circular in LIGO as you go to the right.
Correct.
And then you preserve more of those in LISA.
Exactly. So you can see that in order to see anything here without a template that's 0.4 to 0.9, you don't see anything, okay, once you get there. Here you can hope to see something with a template, say, between 0.1 and 0.4, okay? So basically, as you go in this direction without templates, you just don't see anything. Whereas here, you can, even if it was circular, you can maybe hope to see something, but even then it's pretty hard.
Okay.
So this is basically saying how much extra you will capture as you build in eccentric templates, but without them. And you also see, again, this sharp frequency cutoff. Again, this is for peak frequency, but you see the sharp peak frequency cutoff, which is really interesting, which is saying that, so this is why it's not just a reduction of the number of events, but it's really a reduction of the number of events as a function of frequency. So in some cases, you can even get an enhancement, but then you just get cut off, and you just don't see anything at all. Okay. Is that clear? And this is, so now I'm just going to say the same information just another way, just to show you. So this is here, if you have just a template that's point, so here there's no template for eccentricity, here there's one with 0.4. So what do you see? So if you have circular events, in this case, you capture something. If you have very small eccentricity, like 10 to minus 0.55, you'd see something. You'd see something here. And if you had eccentricity like even bigger, 10 to minus 4, you only have a chance of seeing it if you have the eccentric template. Okay. So and again, but there still is a frequency cutoff. Okay. So this is very idealized because we're just looking at one eccentricity at a time. There's a lot more work to be done. But the point is that there's some really powerful discriminatory power once we combine together LISO and LIGO. Just by counting, right? We're not doing anything fancy here. We're just counting when we have eccentric templates, or not. And like I said, even without the template, we can still say it quite a bit, okay? So that's basically all I was gonna say here. So again, it's just number of events as a function of frequencies. I think it will give us some pretty powerful insights into the eccentricity distribution and hence the formation channels. And again, if you want to test this, there will be lots of interesting ways to test it. One is putting in templates. One is, of course, if there are these intermediate frequency bands. And the other thing is, if you really want to know, distinguish among the different dynamical formation channels, the kind of work I talked about earlier, where you can actually measure Doppler shift, would be able to distinguish them, because they would give different results. And it's just kind of amazing that LISO has just this right frequency, so it seems like it's something we want to take advantage of. So that's all I want to say here.
Okay. So any other comments or questions?
You could ask about the earlier work too. I'm very happy to have this opportunity to tell you what we're doing.
So for any of the, this is the question about the earlier one. So for any of the AGN stuff, are you doomed by the same mass segregation you get from the direct capture models, or can you actually make, I keep asking Carl this question, can you make eccentric binary neutron star systems in AGN? Or does the mass segregation basically screw you and it's all black holes?
It's all black holes?
Give me a mechanism that makes an eccentric binary.
So I think the next talk is going to actually be talking about the disk, and so the mechanism to make the eccentric binary is Kozai-Lyov.
Right.
The question is whether things get close enough to the galactic center.
Right.
And probably the way to do that is to drive it in through a galactic disk. That's probably the most promising possibility, because otherwise you might be driven out.
Right.
But the other thing is, for me, I mean, and maybe you guys think about it differently, but I think we should just leave that an open question. We know what we would predict based on this. We don't really understand the dynamics that well necessarily. So I think it's reasonable to consider this possibility and just see what we measure.
Right.
But I think that's probably the most promising mechanism is coming in through a galactic disk.
Right.
Yeah. Other question?
First question just to you. Can you think of reverse case? So you can see something in LISO but never see it in LIGO, in the sense that at all.
What's that?
Irrespective of
eccentricity. There's lots of things that just don't merge in time to see it in LIGO, right?
No, something that we see it should. No, we see it, it ends the LISA, we don't expect to see it in LIGO, whatever, 5 years. 5 years later, we don't see it. Can you get something?
This comes in neutron star mergers.
but this comes up to the AGNs can do anything, right? We're talking about this like prediction of. What do you see LISO predict in LIGO get the scale organization order submitted?
So I think what you're asking, though,
additional.
But I think he's asking, like, a...
On a very short time scale, you should see the change.
Right.
5 years, have you doing something like that as well?
So I think an example of that might be something like, you don't know that it's eccentric. you think based on what you've seen that you should see it, and what this is saying is you wouldn't see it, and it's eccentric. So there could be lots of cases like that, I think. So I think the point is, if you don't take into account eccentricity, those predictions go wrong.
This is the case of you just did.
Yeah.
Interpreted okay. Right, correctly, in a sense.
Yeah, but that was the question you asked, right? Could you see something in Lisa that you don't see in LIGO?
I think this is really, it's a, you know, theoretical question, but when it goes in practice, to analyzing the data, if you don't have the right template, you just don't see it because you don't see it. Because you have to face a million cycles to see it, right? So if it's eccentric, it's like, if the eccentricity is 0.1,
well, but by the time
you track with a circular, you just don't see it.
If it's 0.1, though, like, you just won't make it to LISA. That was kind of part of our point.
No, 0.1 in LISA, I mean.
Oh, it's 0.1 in LISA.
It's 0.1
in LISA. Then in LIGO, you won't need eccentric. It's going to have negligible eccentricity in LIGO.
Sure.
So then you won't need it. I mean, so once you've seen it in LISA, whatever reason you've seen it.
No, but I'm just making the point that if you don't have the right template with the right eccentricity in LISA, even if the eccentricity is 0.1 in LISA, you're not going to see it because, you know, you have to phase a million cycles. And if you don't have the right phase evolution, so you have the right eccentricity within.
Oh yeah, there's lots of possibilities that you don't see things in LISA.
So it's not it's not that you see a signal in LISA, you screw up the eccentricity, and you predict the wrong time, because if you've seen it, you have the right template with the right eccentricity. So if you screw up in time, there is some other effect. It can just be like, you know, this central mass acceleration.
This is the Laplace layer.
Other thing.
And you have something interesting that screws this up, not because of this issue.
That's a good question.
So the set up correctly, and then it dissipates.
I don't know the answer to that. Yeah.
Whoa.
I think the spirit. I mean, I love the spirit of this, which is you're comparing the populations. You're taking LIGO. You make a unit. You know, to be consistent. You know, you make now statements about the population of LISA, and obviously they're even ignoring eccentricity, just if we assume they're all circular. Now, if you have the LIGO population, and you assume it's only GW-driven, then you make unique predictions for the LISA population, and those have to be consistent. You know, over some mass range, I mean, LIGO doesn't see a lot of what's seen in LISA, so that's just a sanity check. Mm-hmm. And you would argue, you know, if it fails, then that's a sign of eccentricity.
I mean, there is, as you know, like a lot of uncertainty in the rates and the mass function. So, you know, because of course, if everything was the same exact mass, then you could see. But there are uncertainties, so it's not. I mean, so it's going to be interesting to see how well we can make those predictions. But I would say that this is really even within the uncertainties that there are some really interesting statements to make. I mean, part of the reason to do this is once you start thinking about interesting things to look for, then you find ways to look for them. So it's not. Yeah.
I would add to that you know, this is true now, but by the time this applies.
Yeah.
We will have a pretty good handle of what is the mass function and the rates of these things, right? So, pending the eccentricity distribution, because we can measure eccentricity other than 0.1 or 0.05 with LIGO, right? We should know exactly what the population we expect to see in LISA, and then, of course, will be used.
Don't forget there's another point here, which is it won't be LISA and LIGO, it will be LISA and Cosmic Explorer Einstein Telescope, which have much better precision on measuring eccentricity anyway. You can get that
yes.
for the measurements for the eccentricity.
Yes,
so it's not, so the number you have in your head for LIGO is
when you build it, your
Cosmic Explorer. The wasps will pee through the beam tube of LIGO.
If you can build your 40-kilometer tunnel in 10 years.
But I think it's also just worth looking at this plot again, because before there weren't that many super interesting things in that intermediate regime, and this is saying that, you know, if this is true, there's going to be lots of interesting stuff that shows up there that should be correlated with the eccentricity distributions.